Episode number 38 of the Fight Name Picks podcast is brought to you by First Row Collectibles. Head on over to firstrow.ca and use the promo code FNP for free shipping on your order today. We're also brought to you by Sisu Mouthguards, definitely the best boil and bite mouthguard I've ever had. You can go over to their website, it's sisuguard.com, and use the promo code FNP10 for 10% off your order today.
Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for the Fight Night Picks podcast with your host, Frank Allen.
It's Friday, September 14th, another great episode of Fight Night Picks. I have four great guests lined up for you as well. This is just the first of two podcasts coming out, so let's get right into it. All right, and welcome to episode number 38 of the Fight Night Picks podcast. I'm your host, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram now at Craig Allen FNP. So like I said, double drop today. We have two really great podcast episodes. In this episode, we're going to interview four different guests, ACB and former Bellator staple Fernando Gonzalez. We're going to talk to him about what fights he could have coming up later on this year. And let me tell you, you don't want to miss that because there's an interesting little tidbit of news in that interview. We're also joined by Darren the Dentist Stewart, who got a win this past weekend at UFC 228 over Charles Byrd. So we're going to talk to him about the fight and possibly when we could see him back in the cage. We're also joined by Canadian investigative MMA journalist Mike Russell. So we're going to talk to him about his expose piece that he's been working on over the past couple of years about MMA agent and manager Ali Abdelaziz. So it's a really interesting interview there. And last but certainly not least, we're bringing back the featured up-and-comer of the week. It's been a staple of this audio podcast. So we're going to be talking to Caleb Hall, who got a win over CJ Ewer at NEF 35. And of course, I was there live in Bangor last weekend, and it was a lot of fun. Great event. So we'll hear from CJ at the very end of the episode as well. Later on tonight, there will be a Bellator 205 preview show. I'm going to be joined by main eventer AJ McKee. We're also going to be joined by Rafael Lovato Jr. and the one and only Patricky Pitbull Freire. So look forward to that one later on today. It's an audio only drop. Make sure you rate and review the show and let me know if there's any podcatchers that I'm not currently on and you'd like to see the podcast on there. Let me know. Drop me a line on Twitter, what have you. So let's get right into the first interview. Talking to Fernando Gonzalez. We started talking and then I just clicked the record button. So we were talking about why Fernando ended up departing from Bellator and ended up signing in ACB.
You know, for me, I felt like they were kind of set me up a little bit on the weight cuts. They changed the times on both my last two events. So after that, you know, I have a lot of respect for them and they got my name to where it was. But I didn't want to burn that bridge or lose respect for them and you know, cross that line. I was already getting upset, but like I said, they gave me my break and so it was better to part ways.
And I mean, you're finally getting the chance to travel. What was it like going over to England for the first time to fight over there?
Getting over there was cool. Once we were over there, it was a lot of fun. It's big culture change.
Didn't you have a lot of travel issues trying to get over there too?
Oh my God. Yeah. We got stuck in New York. We were supposed to leave at 10 at night. We ended up getting there at like 10:20. I think we missed it by 10 minutes or 20 minutes. So then the next flight wasn't until 6 in the afternoon the next day. So it's like, you know, 10. So by the time we run to this other area or the other airport, we find out we missed it. We run back to try to get our luggage and they're like, it's not here. It's at the other airport. So then we had to run back again. They wouldn't give us our luggage. They said no, everybody was going nuts there. So almost every flight was canceled. So I'm sure the workers were already stressed out. But by the time I got to him, he was like, man, he was an ass. I was like, can I please get my bags? I'll walk them. I'll get it myself. And he's like, yeah, you have to come back tomorrow morning.
Oh.
So yeah, I couldn't even get a room or nothing, man. We ended up sleeping in the airport until six in the afternoon the next day, and finally got on the plane, took off. You know, I felt that it gave me a little bit of a dump in the fight, but it wasn't until the third round that I really felt it. But, you know, it's just those things. It's a life lesson, you know, you got to kind of go through that so the next time it won't be as bad, and hopefully it'll be for a title and I won't get sidetracked and get the win.
So, I mean, in that fight, it was a chance to kind of move back up to middleweight. Is a lot easier for you to fight at middleweight? I know, you know, you've fought at 170, 175 in the past, different weight classes, but what's the plan with ACB? Are you going to stick at middleweight? Could you go back down?
Yeah, in my contract that we wrote, I'm open to both weight classes. So I can do 85, and then, you know, obviously with notice to give me the chance to move down to 70s, I can do that as well. I like floating around both. 185 was way easier just because, like what happened, you never know that stuff's going to happen, you know? So if I had to make 170, I probably would have had to miss, I would have missed weight again.
Yeah.
But being at 185, I got there late, showed up pretty much the day before weigh-ins. I slept as much as I could, woke up and started cutting. And I made the weight really easy, considering especially the delay and everything, you know. So I felt way better at 185. But, yeah, if they give me proper notice and none of that stuff happens, I can make 170s.
I mean, it seems to be a great promotion. I've watched a lot of their events. They put on a really good show. ACB 87 was good. ACB 88 with three title fights. And then this past weekend, another event. So as far as your contract's concerned with these guys, how many fights are on it?
I have six fights with them, but right now the same thing, they're allowing me to fight outside of the promotion just because they're trying to play catch up with the guys that haven't fought yet. So it'd be almost too soon, I think, for them to throw me back on. I put it out there. If you know, Albert Durov needs an opponent, because he was asking for a super fight. So I know more likely that's the one they're going to put together, but if he didn't need it, didn't have anybody, that I would be willing to fight him at down there in Moscow. But right now, we're in the works of trying to get on that Tito Ortiz, Chuck Liddell third card, their third fight. I'm trying to get on that. One of my buddies had to hit me up, and his friend's the matchmaker, and they're starting to put the undercard together. So, you know, my fingers are crossed. I'm hoping to get on that. And you know, like I said, ACB is really, really cool, and they're allowing me to fight outside of my contract. So yeah, right now that's in the works, and hopefully I get that call and get that contract soon.
Yeah, I mean, fingers crossed. You know, you dropped the decision to Struz, tough fight. And of course, Duraev, you know, a lot of people had the cards. I saw some 47, 48s. I saw some, you know, people had five rounds for Duraev on the weekend. So a lot of different scores. But yeah, I mean, whether or not you get the Duraev fighter, you end up fighting on that card with Golden Boy, that'd be pretty special.
Yeah. Oh man, that'd be awesome. Either one of those two, you know what I mean? Obviously I get a title shot if it goes that through ACB, or being on the card like Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz, that's going to be huge. So there's going to be a lot of notice, and then it'll allow me to, for me, I always fight better under those kind of circumstances, you know? So I just feel it'll pull the best fighter out of me and give the fans a great show.
Awesome, Fernando. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Hopefully we get to see you back in the cage soon, whether it's with ACB, whether it's with Golden Boy on that huge super card. For all the fans that are watching at home, where can they find you on social media? And if you have any sponsors to shout out, let us know.
Yeah, you can hit me up on or look me up on Instagram at Menifeemaniac. Same with my Twitter and on Facebook, Fernando the Menifeemaniac Gonzalez.
I'm sure you've all seen the poster that dropped, the old Chuck Tito 3 poster. It was kind of an awkward looking one, but how great would it be to have a veteran middleweight like Fernando Gonzalez fighting on that card? It'd be something special. So we'll have to have Fernando back on before his next fight, whether it's in ACB or if it's in Golden Boy MMA. It's really exciting stuff, and I'm really glad that Fernando joined us. So let's transition into the interview that I had with Darren Stewart. He got the win at UFC 228 over Charles Byrd, a guy who was really on a roll. And now Darren two fights in a row with two knockouts. So exciting stuff from him. And let's hear what Darren has. So
what was it like going into Dallas last weekend and finishing the hometown guy?
Very good, man. I'm excited, you know, because I'm getting booed and they're cheering him on because obviously he's a hometown guy. But it felt really good just putting a hometown guy to sleep in the hometown and listening to the crowd go silent.
I mean, yeah, he wasn't an easy opponent to take on. He was on a four-fight finish streak. You had really great takedown defense in the fight. I believe you stuffed every single attempt, worked in the clinch really well. I know you were trying to look for those elbows. But the takedown defense, was that something that you focused on a lot in training camp?
Of course, man. I always focus on that, man. Always. I know most of the American guys love their wrestling. That's one thing I focus on. I train at Team Titan, innit? A gym called Team Titan, and they work a lot on wrestling. So, you know, it was only right that I defend all them. That's it, really. So,
I mean, you're on a roll right now. You've had two second round finishes in a row. Has it been difficult at all for you dropping down from light heavyweight, moving into middleweight at all?
Repeat that again, sorry.
So you're on a roll right now. I mean, both your last two finishes or fights have been second round finishes, but has it been difficult for you at all dropping down from light heavyweight to middleweight?
No, not at all. I don't like it because it's stressful. As I like heavy, there's no diet. I come home, eat as much chicken as I want, not junk food, but I eat as much as I want. Now you have a calorie deficit. You have to follow a calorie deficit, so, and you're always constantly eating proper good and weighing your food and stuff like that, and making you have to cut weight, and it's not a nice feeling. Now I don't like it. I will never like it. I'll never get used to it, but it's got to be done.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, some people might not know this, but you're also an accomplished dancer. I've seen videos on Instagram and on Twitter, all over the internet. Can you explain kind of how those skills have possibly translated into your success as a fighter?
It plays a part, you know what I mean? It plays a part, but I've been dancing young. I've been dancing before martial arts. I mean, I would have been dancing, but a break dance here and there. I took on salsa, not for my martial art. I took a salsa as a new hobby because I just love dancing. I like new challenges. And then I realized that the cardio and the footwork and salsa also helps you in MMA. So I remember when I used to have a fight week, I used to go out salsa in fight week. So if I'm fighting Saturday, I'll go salsa on a Thursday, get that last bit of cardio, that last bit of sweat, you know, just to make the weight and get the cardio. So now there's no time. I go salsa once in a while. You know, now I do it for fun. Now I do it because my missus is going out. I'm going out with family or friends. I'm not doing it for training, you know. But it did used to play a part. It still does. Don't get me wrong. I still go out to play a part. It does still play a part. But I'm not big on it like I used to be. Like I said, I train 6 days a week. It's too hard. But I do love dancing. That's what I do. I know I shock the world because they think every MMA fight is just, you know, a typical aggressive guy, but I'm unique.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a pretty cool thing to be doing. So, I mean, in 2016, you fought three times. You fought three times last year. We've seen you twice in the cage this year. Is a chance that we see you back again before the end of the year? And if so, is there somebody that you'd really like to fight?
Hopefully, you see me this year. But it's got to be November because my missus is due January. So I'm not trying to fight December or January. So if I do, it has to be November or it'd be February. And anyone in particular? No, I don't do it. I never will. I just don't do these name calling. Like, if I want someone, I don't mind. I don't mind fighting whoever. I haven't got no one specific to say, yeah, I want you. Like, I'm not taking that seriously. Do you know what I mean? Like, it ain't no, I grew up on the street, I want to knock you out kind of thing. No, any day it's sport. You know what I mean? And I'll fight anyone they put in front of me, but it's nothing personal. I want to fight this guy, I want to fight that guy. You know what I'm saying? So whoever they put in front of me, I'll take until they have to sit and wait and see.
Yeah, for sure. It'd be great to see you back in the cage before the end of the year. And I know that MSG card, there's a lot of middleweights on there already, so maybe you could get added to that.
Oh, yeah, that New York?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of middleweight. I know a lot, man. That's already, so
hopefully, possibly, maybe we could see you on that card. Thanks so much, Darren, for coming on. Like I said, hopefully we can see you back in the cage again soon. For all the fans that are watching at home, where can they find you on social media? And if you have any sponsors you'd like to shout out, let us know.
Yeah, so social media, you can find me on Darren_MMA. Now, that's the same for Twitter, Snapchat. So Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat is Darren_MMA. I want to give a shout out to my gym, my friends Mo Curtis, my management Intensity. Shout out to my sponsor ISO Sports. You know, big up, you know, my missus and my son for supporting me. Big up Battles of London, another sponsor of mine as well. Big up yourself, Craig. You know, for doing an interview. So yeah, big up everyone that's trying to support all my fans. You know. Yeah, all the fans, the reason why I'm here today is still going strong, you know, so shout out to everyone, you know.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Really appreciate Darren coming on the show. And one of those last questions that I asked him, I was really interested in because he's an accomplished dancer and he's big into salsa. You can check him out on Instagram at Darren_MMA. And I wanted to see how that transitions into, you know, the sport of MMA. We've seen a lot of football players, like you think Brendan Schaub, Eric Anders, Matt Mitrione, among others, and they found success kind of crossing between football and into MMA. So I wanted to see, you know, you look at Darren's fights, his footwork's really good, and I wanted to see how that's worked for him and how he incorporates it into his game. So interesting stuff from Darren. Great win at UFC 228, and hopefully we can see him either on that UFC 230 card or early on next year. All right, so this episode of the podcast brought to you by First Row Collectibles out of Winnipeg. Like I mentioned, we had Curtis Howson from First Row on the podcast a number of months ago, and I'm proud to still be associated with such a great company. So if you head on over to their website, firstrow.ca, they've got all sorts of memorabilia, hockey cards, baseball cards, Aaron Judge rookie cards, Acuna rookie cards. I mean, the list goes on. First Row's got quite a bit of stuff there for MMA fans. There's MMA autographs. There's a lot of wrestling memorabilia, old issues of Sports Illustrated. I mean, like I said, the list does go on. So head on over to their website, use the promo code FNP, and you'll get free shipping on your order today. And to our American listeners, keep in mind, you know, where they're out of Winnipeg, all the prices on the website are in Canadian dollars. So you're going to be saving, you know, 25% on every order. So head on over there, promo code FNP for free shipping on your order. We're also brought to you by Sisu Mouthguards. Like I said at the start, definitely the best Boil and Bite mouthguard I've ever had. They're almost razor thin. They offer a $35,000 one-year dental warranty. And this, it works. I mean, if you play hockey, if you're in MMA, you can go into your corner. You don't have to pop one of those bulky mouthguards out. You're playing hockey. You can hoop and holler on the ice, call for a pass. You can do whatever you need to do. And I mean, the one game that I didn't wear my mouthguard, lost one of my front teeth, and it cost me about $1,000 in repairs and time spent away from work. So head on over to their website. It's sisuguard.com. Use the promo code FNP10 for 10% off your order. And they recently partnered in June with Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation. So every sale of a yellow Arrow or Junior style mouthguard is going to go to Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, which is a childhood cancer research foundation. So definitely head on over to the website. You can still use the promo code FNP10. And have a look at the mouthguard selections. They're the very best out there on the market, and I really suggest you head on over there. So now let's get into the interview with Mike Russell, MMA investigative journalist, and he had a big kind of expose piece come together over the last couple of years, and there's going to be more interesting news coming out in the near future. So let's hear what Mike has to say. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Great to have a fellow Canadian on. It's not often that I get to have a Canadian content producer. So can you explain kind of how you transitioned from mainstream journalism into more investigative pieces in the MMA world?
Sure. I'll try to give you the abridged version because we could talk all day. So 2006 was when I started kind of in this sport. I was a fan, and I'd answered an ad. It was actually my first year of public relations. I'd gone back to school at 30, and I answered an ad, and the ad was for to do some marketing for a UK-based magazine. And they had no budget, so within like a few weeks, they started asking, "Hey, you're pretty good with writing emails and pitching to different department stores to try to get the magazine in. Would you be okay with writing us some interview questions?" And the people that were running the magazine really had no clue about boxing. They had no clue about MMA. They just kind of wanted to be involved in the sport. So it was kind of where I got my first taste of conflicts of interest as well, because the editor was also running a management business. and he was using the magazine kind of to attract clients. So there was one point where, you know, he didn't pay me at all the whole, like, probably 3 or 4 months that I worked for him. And there was times where the magazine would come out and the questions were written by me, but somebody else took credit for the story. So it was like, you know, kind of, it was an eye opener. And I figured that was kind of my in and out. I was going to be in and out of MMA reporting, I guess, as you call it. Wasn't really, I didn't consider myself a writer. But I interviewed, actually the owner of the Fight Network, which was just starting up at the time in about 2006. And it was for a magazine that basically the magazine issue didn't come out because the owner of the magazine, unbeknownst to him, the editor had taken the money for the next issue and done an MMA seminar that failed. And he ended up, you know, paying for all this advertising, paying for a bunch of tickets. And there were some big name stars on the event that were basically left stranded in the UK. So I was like, well, there goes my career. I'm never going to work at MMA again because of my affiliation with them. But I lucked out because Loretta Hunt was actually looking for a Canadian news correspondent for the Fight Network at the time. So Mike Garrow put me in touch with Loretta. I sent Loretta a few of my articles, and it was, you know, talk about humbling experience. I thought, again, you know, like, I'm not going to get this job. She looked at them and she said, well, you know what? You seem like you know what you're talking about. Like, you seem to have a very good grasp. And she said, I can teach you the other things. But she said, I think we've moved kind of beyond Q&A type journalism. And I'm like, fair enough. So I took that, you know, as a tip. So, you know, I learned kind of under fire with Loretta, where I had to do a weekly column every week that was basically news story. So I was calling, you know, 5, 6, 7 people, you know, like on a Monday at school, I'm on the payphone. And my first investigative piece was actually Bill Mahood got caught using steroids at a Strikeforce event and was suspended. So my, you know, little knowledge of MMA journalism, Loretta always said, get both sides of the story. So I remember I called Bill from a payphone at school with my recorder up, and I was talking, you know, and I'm like, I was wondering if I could get a statement on your failed drug test in California. And he hadn't been made aware of it yet. They hadn't told him. So I'm like, he's like, what are you talking about? And I had to explain it to him, you know, and I'm like, you know, even though I was 30, I wasn't really, you know, versed in what to do in a situation like that. So I'm like, you know, I'm sorry to be the one to break it to you, but this is, you know, I just like your side of the story. So I'm like, well, I'm one and done again. He's never going to call me. I burned that bridge. And it surprised me because he did. He called me back later that day and gave me an exclusive. So I kind of got a taste for, I guess, ethical, getting both sides of the story and kind of, you know, going from there. So my career basically kind of took weird twists and turns where I was working, you know, more kind of part-time, working for magazines, working for contributed like Fox Sports Online, Yahoo Sports Online, Fight Magazine, Fight Authority Magazine, Fight World Magazine, Fighters Only I mentioned. But I landed at Cage Potato. And at Cage Potato, we were kind of like, they called us like the Mad Magazine or the Cracked Magazine of MMA, because it was like a guy's website where they put up like bikini girls and all that kind of stuff, like ring girls and stuff. So I right from the beginning when they hired me to replace Ben Folks, I was like, I don't want to do that. That's not kind of my trajectory and what I want to do in the sport. I kind of want to be more taken seriously. So it gave me like free rein to be able to do a lot of investigative work and kind of teach myself. So a lot of the stuff that I was learning, either, you know, I picked up from Loretta. I had like she gave me the Canadian Association of Journalists ethics guidelines. And that was kind of my Bible. I've actually got it up on my board here that I check through it quite often. It gives you just kind of a baseline, because a lot of people don't realize that journalists don't really have like a Hippocratic Oath. You know, and people kind of look at us and say, well, you're a journalist, so like basically we trust you and we trust that what you're telling us is what we need to know. So journalism is supposed to be the checks and balances of those in power and kind of how they affect everything kind of below them. But not a lot of people, I think, in our space kind of look at it that way. We're more, like you explained earlier, we're more looked at as content creators. So yeah. For me, I had a real eye-opening experience. And I think because Cage Potato, I had such free rein because I was a senior editor, I kind of got to write whatever I wanted to without checking with anybody. So I would write what was important. You know, I found out that there was a promotion in Australia that had stiffed all of these ex-UFC and Pride fighters from their purses. So I did an expose on that. I got both sides. And that was kind of where I really kind of started, honing my craft. lost the job at Cage Potato due to cutbacks, and I kind of just started freelancing here and there and kind of fell back on my PR diploma. And I have a family, so I have, you know, five kids, and you know, that was Cage Potato paid me actually more than all of my unionized jobs that I had in technology before I'd gone back to school. But because of 9/11, I lost a couple of those, one of those jobs specifically, because it was in the aircraft industry. So I thought, you know what, PR is something I could always fall back on. And then I thought, well, journalism, you know, as soon as I started kind of getting, climbing the ranks and getting notice and having people call me, like I don't know if I've ever really applied for any jobs that I got in this sport. It was more so just word of mouth or editors would reach out to me. So I'd been away for about a year, all in around 2014, and I wanted to come back, and there was an opening at Yahoo Sports. So I get into Yahoo Sports, and it was a rude awakening of what I could and couldn't do. First, I had full access to write whatever I wanted, and then they kind of took that away from me. And I was like, well, that's weird, because everything I've written has been newsworthy. Well, then I had to pitch. And then, you know, at $25 an article, which was the lowest I'd ever been paid, I'm pitching articles all day. And I just been laid off from a job. So I'm trying to treat this like legitimate job again. And there would be a week I would pitch and not get a single bite. And then it started becoming clear, without giving me a list of who to write about. It's like, Conor McGregor, 100%. Floyd Mayweather, yes. George St. Pierre, yes. So what they're doing is they're using either their past knowledge of what sells, or they're using the same kind of needle mover list that the UFC decide on who to make a star. You know, and that goes, it goes a lot of things. There's working on a story right now kind of about data collection and how all of our websites that we go to every day to get our MMA news are making money. It's gotten to the point where newsworthiness has now kind of been blurred, and the lines have been blurred between what is clickworthy. So
yeah, exactly. So I mean, and one of the big things that you did when you went, you know, more of a freelance investigative kind of angle, I guess, is that you started writing content about Ali Abdelaziz, and it just sort of began a ripple effect. Now, how did you get involved in that kind of topic? How did you really start to get into that?
Sure. So actually, my website I launched as a result of Yahoo rejected a story that I'd pitched. I actually pitched them a story. They accepted it. It was about Cody McKenzie. And when I handed it in, it was like radio silence. It's like, well, the fight's tomorrow. I'm not hearing back. Finally, they came back and said, to be frank, two things. One, it's too long, which is like, you're paying me the same no matter how long the story is. Number two was they said it wouldn't resonate with the readership, because it was kind of, it painted almost like a, like Chuck Mindenhall's story about Jason Thacker. It kind of painted a more sensitive picture of some of the things that Cody had gone through. How I started digging in was this fight that he had in Edmonton. He was kind of unlawfully suspended. And that's where my website, my very first story that I did was about his illegal suspension. I presented the audio of the executive director of that commission in Edmonton admitting that he'd illegally suspended him by drawing a bunch of like coaches, local coaches together to vote on his suspension. And then I started pushing for the city to do something about it. Well, all of a sudden it unraveled this whole corruption scheme, basically, that, you know, this guy got his job through corruption and through cronyism, and he was absolutely unqualified for the job. So then my investigative work started going from there, where I like found, I got a copy of his resume and found out that he'd lied to all these people on his resume. And, you know, from there, for about 2 or 3 years before I actually started the Ali Abdelaziz investigation, I was looking into Edmonton, which I don't know if you knew, it kind of culminated with the Tim Hag dying in Edmonton story. And I was the one that discovered that this executive director that had been kind of in my target for all of the different things he'd done, like letting Ryan Jimmel fought Sokaju, and Sokaju used tampered gloves. And, you know, there are all these different situations that were happening that were like, A, unsafe, B, favoring certain sides of certain things, like with issues. He was treating kind of outside fighters as though they were the enemy, and kind of, you know, giving them a real hard time when it came in, like letting, like, you know, their opponents, like corner men in their dressing room, having physical confrontations with them and without any problem. So with Ali Abdelaziz, when I had taken my slight pause, I guess, from journalism, I was still contributing some magazines and stuff, but I wasn't doing full time. So I had to lean on my PR degree. I went and I was working for Fund a Fighter, which was owned by one of the guys that owns the building that TriStar's in. So there's this kind of affiliation with TriStar. So I worked basically there for 2 years. We couldn't come to terms with my renegotiation, so I left. But during that time, we had a few fighters that were having issues with Ali, that the guy that was basically my boss from Fund a Fighter did stuff like he backdated contracts with a fighter to protect them from Ali forcing them to sign with him. So I was getting kind of all these different bits of information that I've been collecting. At the time, we were kind of looking. Rick Hahn didn't have any sponsors. He was at TriStar at the time. So for free, I built a database on my own time and was calling sponsors. And then, you know, things were happening. Like, I was getting calls back from sponsors that agreed to say, yeah, actually, we got a call from this Ali guy saying that Rick is his Rick's sponsor, managed by Ali. And so I was all like worried that I'm like, well, if he's your manager, I don't want to step on any toes. We're doing this for free. The difference was we were taking nothing from the sponsorships and Ali was taking 20%. So it was like, we explained it to Rick, you know, like, hey man, it's up to you if you want to just leave it as it is. But like, really, you should be getting, if we're going to give it all to you and somebody else is going to take a percentage. So then TriStar guys started sending me all this other info about Ali, where he was trying to say, I'll get you in World Series of Fighting, but you have to sign your guys over to me, to managers. So he was making these like illegal deals where it was like, basically the only way to play is if you sign over a certain amount of your money to me. So it's, that's a really big deal. And like in boxing, guys have lost their licenses. There was, who was it now? Don King's son lost his license because he was kind of doing both sides, you know, as far as matchmaking and managing at the same time. So I kind of started with that was the story I was going to tell. It never actually got told, only kind of, you know, on podcasts like this, but it was funny. People say, well, how did you get onto the story? I said, well, I actually, the night before my story came out, I was writing this story about all the stuff that he was doing illegally, because John Nash and Paul Gift had come out with their story that questioned, like, was he acting illegally in both of these? And I'm like, I've got evidence of that. I'm going to put it out. So I was going to just give it to them because I thought, well, you know what? People will say I have some sort of conflict of interest, even though I never made any money from anything I did from, you know, there's always going to be somebody that's going to look at, and, you know, even though going through my ethics guidelines and everything, I'm like, you know what? I kept, you know, this is this and this is that, I thought. So I never told that story, but the night before I was going to write it, and I tweeted at Ali, I said, listen, I'm going to write what I know that you know I know. I've got phone calls taped. I've got everything, and he knows it, right? So I kind of, in my style, which a lot of people don't like, they always say I've got like a personal vendetta. I did the same thing with Pat Reed. I was tweeting at him, you know. It's just kind of my, I guess, I'm a big fan of Hunter S. Thompson, so like the Gonzo style of journalism where like you kind of talk about all the stuff that you've kind of done in behind the scenes more. So anyway, I asked for an interview with Ali, and he ignored it, and then I got a DM from somebody alleging that they were a World Series of Fighting exec. And they said, I've got a story for you. And I'm like, okay, well, with anything, you kind of, when you get contacted about anything, you kind of question the source first. Because I've seen there were people when I first started that were fooled into thinking that there was one in particular. It was Marco Antico at MMA Weekly got fooled into thinking he was interviewing Andre Arlovsky. It was a total fraud. So I'm like, you know, when I get this, I kind of look at it, but it's a good starting point. So they kind of gave me some keywords, not necessarily keywords, but as a, you know, I'm pretty good at investigative work. I start plugging them in and looking, and I came upon this book that Ali had actually collaborated with the author on. And it was, you know, I've got the real story now of how that came about and how the author actually secretly recorded him, because I ended up working for a guy that worked with the author doing research on Ali's cult that he was in. But, you know, I guess we're getting ahead here. So I find all this info in this book and I'm like, great. And then I told a guy in the MMA community about it because he had been having problems with Ali. And I was like saying, well, you know what? Seems like there's more to this story than meets the eye. Well, he tweeted about it and tweeted the clues, basically, you know, like I think it was like New York City, NYPD, FBI, certain manager, and like all these different ties with an Islamic terrorist group. Well, there's only a certain amount of probably people in MMA who are, you know, Muslim to begin with. So it didn't take long before I get a phone call from one of the guys that, you know, I'd spoken to earlier about one of the stories that I was like, hey, if you guys want to do it. And then, you know, people started catching on that they found the book and they started, you know, moving on it. So I stayed up all night and kind of one off wrote the first story. I wasn't super happy with it because I didn't have a lot of time to investigate it. And I got, you know, bashed and criticized by peers that, you know, it was so vague, you didn't have the evidence. So I took the last 3 years basically since the first story came out to find, you know, all of the evidence. And since then I've talked to FBI agents, NYPD agents, CIA agents, Homeland Security agents, ex-wives and girlfriends, green card brides that I've dug up, you know, and people within this group that I've made contacts with that speak about Ali. So I'm pretty confident now that I kind of have the big picture of everything that went on. And people ask why I took my other stories down. They're like, oh, it must have been fake and everything else. If I'm not 100% confident with what I've put out, you know, I probably will put a statement out about why I've done that other than with you. But I wasn't 100% confident with all of the facts that I'd presented, because a lot of them that were based on the book, which were based on his words, didn't line up with evidence I was given by people when I did fact checking. And as I told you earlier, I made a connection with one of his NYPD handlers, and he gave me some advice. He said, the one thing I will tell you if you ever get to interview him, and I told him I had interviewed him before, and you know, there'd been some similar situations where he'd lied to me. He said, fact check everything that he says, because we found out through, you know, working with him for about 7 or 8 years that a lot of the things that we did fact check ended up being either partial truths or total mistruths. And he said he'll do anything he can to make himself look good, and he'll do anything that he can to get himself out of trouble. So, you know, everything that when he's been asked about my work since then, mostly by Ariel, because he's the only one that's asked him. He's just dismissed and called me, you know, like names and, you know, like deflected with like, you know, derogatory, like gay slurs towards me and everything else. But he's never really answered it. He kind of answers it with another question, which is, it's a sign of a con man, right? When you never answer what you're asked and you kind of change it and deflect. So, you know, he's asked about when can you talk about your past? When can you talk about these allegations that you were a member of a terrorist organization, you know, whether it be he was with the group before, which I do have evidence he was with them before he was arrested, whether or not, you know, he's got a kid in the group as well. But, you know, like, it's not up to us to decide why, where, when, whatever. We'll let the facts lay where they are. But he always just answers with the, if I was a bad guy, would I have, you know, Henzo Gracie, would I have, starts naming other people. And that's another sign. It's that he is using the reputations of others to kind of elevate his own reputation. And it's when you look at the timeline of his time with the NYPD, with, you know, before the NYPD, when he was lying about being an Olympian so he could do certain things around Colorado, everything goes back to the fact that he was not who he said he was. And everything was either someone else's fault, or it was based on people he knew kind of vouch for him. So yeah, there were real Olympians that kind of allowed him to get into the Olympic Training Center because he was friends with them and they kind of vouched for him. And, you know, he's very good at one line that is one of his ex NYPD handlers. And I've been in contact with all of them, but we can't talk about it because he actually called the NYPD to have one of his handlers, who I did name, arrested. And this specific handler actually told me, I can't talk to you about all of this stuff, but I will. He gave me that line about him being a liar. Well, he called to try to have him arrested for talking to me. Not, you know, admit lying and saying that none of it's true, but behind the scenes, he's actually trying to make moves to, you know, this specific detective. I think Ali actually hurt his career by outing his real identity. There were questions whether or not there were threats towards this man's elderly mother who Ali was calling. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff that went on that, you know, kind of, you know, a lot of damage, I think, that was done by some of the moves that he made and some of the lies that he told. But
I mean, exactly. Like, moving forward, we've seen him, you know, he's always at events. You talk about World Series of Fighting a lot. You know, he was involved with the company. I've seen him at PFL events where they show him on TV. I mean, I'm sure he has no affiliation with the actual company. He doesn't have a role there, but he's still a big fighter manager. So, I mean, moving forward, late 2018, early 2019, I'm sure you're going to continue with the investigative work. where can people find, you know, your work, and where can they find, you know, if you're going to keep moving on with this narrative, where can we find more, more info?
Sure. My website's just about ready to go back up. I took it down because there were some updates I wanted to do to it. And obviously the stories that I didn't feel were 100% accurate, I've taken down for the time being. I'm going to retell them in a multi-part podcast. It's going to be probably 6 to 10 episodes. We haven't quite set it yet. I've got a really good professional producer. The writing's almost done. It's just a matter of me getting the last few sources that I've spoken to and want to speak to again, just to clarify some information. But it'll probably be up before the Khabib fight, we're thinking. Like maybe the week or two before, wow, we'll have at least an episode or two up. And then it'll just be a weekly thing. But it'll be kind of based on like Patreon as well too. So we're going to put out some of the stuff for free. People with Patreon, if they want to pay a little bit extra to have access to the actual documents that I have. And I think I showed on Twitter, I've got a binder now of police and court documents. It's about 2 inches thick with mug shots and everything. So, you know, some of his fighters have actually questioned whether this is all real. Vinny Magalesh actually made a comment on Twitter that if I could prove that any of his crimes that I'm accusing him of were legitimate with certified documents, he'd actually leave Ali. He deleted the tweet since, but I've got all the documents now that I will be releasing. But, you know, I think that kind of makes it a little bit harder for people to dismiss the story. So realfightstories.com should be up shortly. Right now, if you click on it, you can kind of see the preview for the project I'm working on right now. Twitter is probably the one that I'm most active on. So Mike Russell MMA on Twitter, same thing on Instagram as well. So yeah, all of those channels, usually Twitter, you'll find kind of get the first word on what's next and what's coming out and everything else, because I'm most active there.
Great having a fellow Canadian on in Mike Russell, and make sure you check him out at Mike Russell MMA as well as realfightstories.com once things become more available. That Ali Abdelaziz story, there's so many moving pieces with it, and I'm sure we're going to see more things coming out in the near future from Mike. So now we're going to get into something that I used to get really excited about on the audio only podcast, my featured up and comer. And what I used to do was I go through Tapology, I do a deep dive on the Fight Center, and I pick and choose fighters on those cards that were finding success. Now it could have been later on in their career. It could have been maybe they're undefeated. They're something like 10-0 and nobody's really heard of them before. So I'm really glad to be joined by somebody who competed at NEF 35, where I was last weekend, in Caleb Hall. And he's gone 2-0 as a pro, 7-3 as an amateur. He's found a lot of success as a professional because his first two fights he's won by submission. And the very first one, he was actually credited with a Von Flew choke. So we're going to hear from Caleb, you know, kind of how his skill sets have transitioned and worked so well from, you know, coming up through high school and now into an MMA career. And what's possibly next for him, because NEF 36 is taking place November 17th from Aura in Portland, Maine, which is where Caleb's from. So possibly we could see him on that card, but let's hear. Caleb, thanks so much for coming on. You know, you got the win over CJ Ewer last weekend at NEF 35. What was it like kind of preparing for a guy like Ewer? I mean, he had fought at middleweight in the past.
Yeah. I just knew he was a tough guy, good wrestling. I just, you know, I had a really good training camp. I felt good going in. I was, coming down from 185, I figured it's going to be a tough weight cut for him. It's got to be a tough weight cut. And he's older. He's, you know, I think he's around 38, 39.
Yeah.
So I knew he wouldn't recover as well as, like, I could, because I'm 14 years younger. But, yeah, I want to get back to my wrestling and push the pace on him. But just ended so fast that didn't have to do that.
No, for sure. So, I mean, for the folks at home who don't know, how did you get involved with MMA?
Well, I got back into it in high school. I wrestled my whole life, so, you know, I was watching it. I wasn't really huge into MMA at first until I saw how good all the wrestlers were doing. So I thought it was something, you know, maybe I could be good at that. And then once I started training, I just fell in love with it. It became my life.
Why do you think that wrestling is such an important skill set to have in MMA?
I think it's the most important skill set because it teaches you so much about discipline and hard work. And you really see from a young age in wrestling however much time you put in is how good you're going to be. And also, you know, it makes jiu-jitsu a lot easier.
I mean, your first two pro fights, both submission wins. You got the win on the weekend. You know, you went 7-3 as an amateur with fights against guys, like I mentioned, like Josh Harvey, Aaron Lacy. I mean, when do you think we're going to be able to see you back in the cage, and who would you like to go up against?
I'm not sure when I'm going to fight next. Next one's in Portland, which is where I live, so that's heavy on my mind, fighting in Portland again. But we'll see. Got some injuries I got to let heal. I'll talk to my coaches, and we'll make a plan within the next week.
For sure. Well, awesome, Caleb. Thanks so much for coming on. Hopefully we can have you back again before your next fight and possibly see you at the NEF 36 card. I'm going to be there for sure in November. So for the fight fans out there, where can they find you online? If you've got any sponsors to shout out, let us know.
You can find me on my Instagram, Caleb Hall MMA. Yeah, give me a follow. Also on Facebook.
Really glad to have had Caleb on the show, and he's definitely a guy that you want to watch out for because I think he's got really big things coming up in his future. I mean, 2-0 as a pro, 2 first-round submission wins, really great wrestling, and I mean, he was taking on a bigger guy in CJ Ewer. I mean, he was 5'6", but he did recently compete at middleweight, and he dropped down to lightweight in this fight. So a tough one for Caleb, but he got the win. So hopefully you can get on that NEF 36 card coming up November 17th. Hometown in Portland, so it'd be great for him. Like I said, later on today, I've got the Bellator 205 preview show coming up on iTunes and Stitcher. I've got AJ McKee, Rafael Lovato Jr., and the one and only Patricky Pitbull Freire. So that one's coming up on iTunes and Stitcher. Now, like I said, let me know in the comments below. I'll get it on whatever podcatchers that you guys are listening to. So let me know where you like to listen to the podcast, and I'll try my best to get it on there. I know CastBox is one of the ones that I'm looking at, and I'm going to try my best before the end of the day to have it on there. So that just about does it for this episode of Fight Night Picks. Like I said, you can find me on Twitter, at CraigAllenFNP. Same handle on Instagram. I'm new with the pictures. I'm trying my very best, but I'm having a lot of fun doing it. As well, head on over to FightNightPicks.net. I had a conversation with Anthony Smith earlier on this week. Got to ask him some neat, interesting questions, and also, if he's going to keep that Return of the Mac walk-in song. And I pulled him aside afterwards and asked him that. And he said, yeah, for sure, and told me the story. So a lot of fun and a great week for Fight Night Picks. So make sure you check out the content. And we'll see you again tomorrow with a YouTube live show previewing UFC Moscow.